Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is a Win Tracy recording, and it is one. Excuse me, it is 3:07 p.m., and that is Friday. So it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes, and that's July 15th. Thought we'd kick off with Equinor. So Norway's gas production is increasing, and that has been a lifesaver for, or potentially at least a lifesaver for a lot of people in. Continental Europe. So Equinor is back in the region of the 200-day moving average, and it's also in the region of the peaks from back in 2014 and 18. So we're at the upper side of what was a pretty lengthy range. The only time that it exceeded those levels was back in 2008. So this is a an area of potential support. We've got previous resistance at this level, and it's also the region of the 200-day moving average. When we think, though, about the impact that this has had on gas prices, we look at UK natural gas. It came down in a dynamic manner in here today. Perhaps more importantly, the peak that was registered back in March has not been exceeded. When we look at 10 years of history, it really does help to just ram home how high prices are right now relative to where they were previously. And any good news on the supply front will help to bring those prices down to more acceptable levels. It will certainly be welcomed by a lot of people. Now, of course, there's also the outstanding question about will Russia open up the Nord Stream 1 pipeline on the 21st? So it is scheduled to be closed from the 11th to the 21st. And that's been the case on repeated occasions over the last few years. Russia doesn't really have an incentive to restart supply. They are still prosecuting their war in Ukraine. They have a clear objective that they want to take over the whole country. They're not going to settle for Donbass and Donetsk. So that would suggest that this is going to be a long, drawn-out affair. But at least we have a downward dynamic for the first time now in a while for Netherlands natural gas. So the prospect, at least, of Norway supplying additional gas to Europe means that they will potentially be able to fill storage tanks. And that's been a massive source of uncertainty. So when we look at some of these European indices, they took their cue from Wall Street today and they're starting to bounce. Now, the DAX is right in the region of the lows from earlier this year, and we had the first evidence really of a good sized upward dynamic and the reversal of yesterday's rather stiff decline and at least some support in the 12,500 point level. Then, if we just look at the Euro stocks, the broader index, it's also bouncing from the region of the March low. And then the euro, which has been down and testing the parity level against the dollar for the last 4 days, has also steadied. Now we have a really short-term oversold condition, so it's really not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we get some pause of consolidation here. The ECB is only just on the cusp of raising interest rates, and they're certainly not going to be in a hurry to do so. But almost a worst case scenario for Europe has been priced in because of Russia's clear intention to force some hardship on European consumers to test their resolve in supporting Ukraine. In fact, that's practically the entire bet of the Russian administration. They're willing to bet that consumers in Western Europe are not going to have the gumption necessary to stand up to bullying from Russia, and that that a protest movement would evolve and break down the unanimity of support for Ukraine among European countries. And it's a potentially realizable prospect that that could occur. And of course, if Europe is really short of natural gas in the winter, and people are called, then obviously the protest movement could easily pick up and could easily also be exaggerated through disinformation campaigns propagated by Russian intelligence forces. These are all not simply potential, almost what would have in decades past been considered to be airy fairy negative type of almost conspiracy theories. Unfortunately, in this day and age, these types of campaigns are just real world politics and geopolitics. So it's exceptionally likely that in the event that Norway can help to supply more gas to Europe, that Russia is obviously then going to have to deploy countermeasures to that. Therefore, I think it is still likely that they're going to ensure that no further gas comes through on the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. And that's going to be a source of volatility. It makes sure that Europe is going to be in a tight position for just about all of the winter. It also, I think, highlights just where we are in terms of the geopolitical condition, that whole new supply chains are going to have to evolve because of the sanction regime that's being implemented against Russia. Now, when we think about the wider market, this is, I think, the most important thing, that money supply growth is contracting again. So it was up at, or it was running at in excess of 20% for almost a year. Now we're down to about 6.5% on a year-over-year basis. So this is now approximating levels that would have coincided with rather easy monetary conditions. Certainly, we got up to about 10% in 2008 and 9, and the same thing again in 2011, 12. So now we're coming back down into the range. When we think about what are the kinds of things that help to support asset prices? Well, one would be clearly a value proposition. Then, if you have a value proposition, it's always handy to be able to have funds available so that you can go off and buy as much of it as possible. So value is starting to come back in, but money supply growth is still contracting. So when we think about the Nasdaq, for example, it's come back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and we've had a succession of higher reaction lows since the middle of June. So this is some evidence of support building in the short term. We could also argue that we had a similar condition back in January and February, and then it was rather swiftly knocked back. The hallmark of a secular bull market is support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, but that's really just applicable to stocks because we have plenty of back history to support it. And it's quite normal to see some support coming through here, and not least because we're overextended relative to the 200-day moving average. So the other main consistency characteristic is that there's a succession of lower rally highs that's been evident since November. And that will have to be broken in order to clearly demonstrate that we are back in a demand-dominated environment beyond short-term steadying. But one thing that's quite clear is that valuations have improved. So the S&P 500 is back at a PE ratio that's about average. And then because we've had such extraordinarily large pullbacks in companies like Netflix, where it's come from 700 to about 190, well, then that's helping to support the bullish argument. Now, the share was up in a reasonably dynamic manner in here today, and it really doesn't look like much because of the size of the decline. So if, even if when we look at it on a log scale chart, it's just fallen so much that even a 6 or 7% advance doesn't register. But they are starting to advertise now. They're trying to promote their most recent movie. And hopefully, or at least they're hoping, that that's going to improve subscriber retention. And that people might take out a subscription because they want to watch the movie. And then they might decide that they're going to hold on to Netflix for a few months. So that's at least a plan to try and improve subscriber numbers. But I think the more important point here is that the loss that they are ma anticipating is contracting. They are still spending a ton of money on providing new programming, but the price to sales ratio is now about 2.8. And the PE ratio has come in significantly. So it's now at about 17. Now, when we look at where their PE ratio was in the past, well, then we get a very different picture. So it's not all that long ago that it was in excess of 100, and now we're talking more like a market comparable 17 level. So this is not priced like a growth stock, which is reasonable because Netflix high growth period is in fact over. So now it's more likely that we're going to move into a much less impressive period of ranging, and there will be substantial peak to trough swings. But it's unlikely that Netflix is going to get back to the $700 level anytime soon. Then we can think about Facebook, or what they call themselves, Meta these days, and we've seen an equally impressive decline, down 60%, coming from about 400 to 150, and we're also starting to see a little bit of steadier action. And Netflix has got some serious business problems. Meta has got a challenge in the fact that they didn't capture the latest demographic. TikTok captured the youngest demographic. Roblox is attempting to go after an even younger demographic. It's not at all sure whether Roblox will be able to generate revenue from a very, very, very young cohort of people, most of them below the age of 10 years old. They're hoping that they can survive long enough to capitalize on capturing the attention of that very young cohort. But the most important point is that Meta failed. They didn't get the Generation Z group, and they don't get the ones after that either. So what are they going to come up with? And the market is certainly not particularly impressed with this whole talk about the metaverse. And one of the biggest challenges with trying to promote the metaverse is the fact that it's very heavy on the eyes. I know for myself that I can sit in front of my computer all day, every day, and not have double vision. But if I play Beat Saber, and I was really enjoying the boxing game what's it called? The Quest. And I couldn't really play it for more than about half an hour. And after half an hour, then I was really feeling strain in my eyes. But I found that even the day after, my eyes were still feeling strained. Now, how on earth are we going to get people using headsets like that if there's that kind of eye strain? Now, it might not matter to young people, but you're not going to capture billions of subscribers or billions of people without their attention being dominated for hours a day. And this eye strain question is really an important one. Now, light and motion, which had some of those absolutely incredible 3D videos in the last decade, came out with their own headset this week. So we're seeing more competition for virtual reality headsets. And I don't know that the technology question about eye strain has really been tackled. So it seems to be a lot of marketing, but not a lot of concrete, I think, progress has been made in trying to tackle some of these really intractable questions. Because you can't expect people to spend all day, every day, surfing around on the metaverse and replicating real life in a virtual world if they can't see properly. But then there's also this bigger question that's been going around in here this week about subscriptions. So Netflix really pioneered the subscription model for streaming. They were able to twin high-speed internet with basically taking over the TV, providing a streaming service that basically then broke the cable companies, broke up the cinema producer or content provider relationship, and they were able to capture huge market share. Computer game companies were the ones who developed microtransactions. So a microtransaction is simple enough that you sell somebody the product, and then if they want added benefits, they have to pay extra for it. Now, BMW is trying to take that a step further. And in their new vehicles, they're going to come equipped with heated seats and a heated steering wheel, and then they want you to pay for using them in the event that you do want them. Now, it seems like it's going to cost extra money to equip every new car with the infrastructure, and then only a percentage of people will buy it. And there's a whole list of additional added extras that they anticipate people will pay for on an ongoing basis. Now, this is very similar to the kind of programming that Microsoft went through. They were able to turn their business from being a highly cyclical software provider to being a cash flow streamlined subscription service by adopting a subscription business model through the 365 product rather than selling iterations of their software every 3 or 4 years. But that's a lot more difficult to do with physical or physical products like cars. And Apple is also talking about creating a buy now, pay later or the product range for its iPhones, and then they're also talking about leasing iPhones to people. So, as interest rates rise, this fractional ownership, or I guess it's really more like renting and delayed ownership, is something that's being developed by companies to try and leverage cash flows without demanding a big upfront cost. Now, BMW is in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and it did come through with better earnings in here today. But the big challenge is that the subscription business model worked beautifully with the big software companies, where the software company has a very strong moat. So they are going to be able to, they succeed in providing a service because there's not really anywhere anyone else can go. So that was really why Microsoft did so well. But then we can think about Adobe. Adobe basically pioneered the service, and it the share really did spectacularly well. But that success encouraged competition. So now you can right click on your Word document in Microsoft and you can create a PDF. Well, Adobe basically invented PDFs and now anybody can do it. If you want editing software for photos, well, if you're a professional, you might still use Photoshop. But the vast majority of people now are editing their photos via their Snapchat or via their phones, so they don't need it. So this is obviously then a really problematic that you have a product and you're trying to sell subscriptions to it, and people then just go for free options. Well, then there's no reason then why the company would ever get back to that 700 level. So it's not like every company that has come down in a big way is suddenly going to recover. And then also, you look at a company like Adobe, and it still has a price to sales ratio of 10, and that's almost after a 50% decline in the share price. So we're still talking about expensive companies in some cases. It's not every company that's had a big pullback is suddenly cheap. We can also think about companies like Unity Software. So the share has come back by 80%, and it was in negative territory again in here today. When we think about valuations, well, the valuations are definitely correcting. It's down now to a price to sales ratio of 8. Well, 8 is still high, but it's not nearly as high as it was before. So back in December, it was trading at a price to sales ratio of 35. So we've definitely had a lot of valuation contraction right across the technology sector. And it does suggest that we're going to start to see value opportunities arising here. There are certainly going to be companies that are cash flow generative. And this significant drawdown in the wider technology sector is going to have, or it's going to provide companies that are better positioned, that are less levered now, the opportunity to capture market share. And it's not like every technology company is going to fail, but those that are in a better position financially today to take advantage of those failures are going to come out as being the really big companies of the future. So the video streaming and video meetings sector is probably a good example of that. So Zoom Media has come down from about 400 to 100, and the price has been ranging now for the last 3 or 4 months. And it's still trading at about 5 times book value. But it's not going to be valuations that determine the survival of the company. It's going to be the cash burn rate. So they have about 5.7 billion in cash. And they're still generating profits. So Zoom will survive. When we think about RingCentral, the reality is that there isn't really room for a large number of these companies. So RingCentral does not have the same amount of free cash flow. It's a smaller business overall. And then, of course, you have the reality of other companies that provide a very similar service. So Skype does very much the same thing, and it's owned by Microsoft, and that's going to stay as a significant party. Now, it doesn't, of course, it also means that Microsoft could decide that they want to take a bigger part in it, and they'll go out and buy one of the constituents. This is exactly what Amazon did just this week. They went out and paid some money to take a 15% stake in Grubhub. So They're going to then make Grubhub available to all their Prime subscribers for free for a year. So Prime subscribers are going to get free deliveries for a year. And that's obviously then going to at least be a challenge for Just Eat, which was one of the big technology companies in Europe and is now still trending lower. Whereas Amazon, having pulled back exceptionally violently, is at least beginning to steady. So there's definitely going to be a concentration factor where we're going to end up with fewer companies, but that those companies will have captured significant market share. So this process of consolidation is going to take years to unfold, and the companies that come through it are going to be in a very strong position. So if this process of consolidation takes time, then what's going to happen between now and when that consolidation is done? Well, it's likely that we're going to have a good deal of ranging. And it's really going to come down to money supply. Now, one thing that I think is particularly relevant here is that the 10-year yield is still hovering around the 3% level, and it has not broken back above it. It was looking really likely that we were going to get an additional pop up towards the 3.5% level last week, following the big upward dynamic. And then it came back down again in here this week. There was an exceptionally large amount of bearishness about bonds, and that there was the assumption that we are back in a new environment, that the bond bull market is over, and that we're going to have a significant inflationary problem indefinitely. Now, the reality is that even in the 1970s, inflation didn't all happen at once. We had bouts of inflation. There were times when yields popped on the upside, and then they came straight back down again in exceptionally violent fashion. And then things evened out for a while, and then they started getting worse again. And of course, we had the oil shocks along the way. So that then contributed to inflationary pressures. So it's quite clear right now that the potential for oil shocks is quite relevant today because of what's going on with Russia. And the thing I think that is less discussed about Russia is trying to understand what their motivations are. Russia's excess death rate from the coronavirus has been much higher than everywhere else. They already have the highest gap between the mortality of men and women. So men are dying much younger than women in Russia. And that is both a factor of the exceptionally hard work and living conditions, and also the epic nature of alcohol consumption. So then there's been, so even though Russia has spent a lot of money trying to encourage population growth, making really substantial payments to women to try and encourage them to have children, it has not been successful. And more to the point, it's not simply that the population is contracting, but that we're getting a mass migration, that people are moving out of the hinterland and into the Moscow-St. Petersburg axis. Then you have the reality that permafrost is melting. So they reckoned, and this is from official government statistics from 2019, that they were going to have to spend somewhere between $250 and $500 million a year in repairing roads because of damage from permafrost melting. Now, of course, that's most particularly problematic around major railways and also then around pipelines. So, on top of the roads issue, they have a 250, excuse me, they have $110 billion estimate on what it's going to cost to repair pipelines. But then you have these additional problems with buildings falling down, with holes just evolving overnight because the foundation has moved in a house, people feeling unsafe where they're living, so they just pick up and leave. So then you're left with the breadbasket, or I guess the major areas where one can anticipate that all the revenue for the country is going to come from in producing oil, gas, and industrial resources, and nobody wants to live there. These are existential problems for any country. But then you also have the additional fact that the oil wells are drilled through the permafrost, and the oil coming up and the gas and the gas liquids that are coming up from exceptional depths are coming up exceptionally hot. So that melts the permafrost around the wellhead. Now you can't simply turn those off, because then the ground would refreeze. Then you'd have to re-drill the well. And that comes at an exceptionally high cost as well. So Russia is looking to be, on the one hand, stable, and on the other hand, instable or unstable. And the exceptional challenges within the country engender this sense of insecurity among the ruling class. And then they look at their internal problems and they believe that everyone else knows them as well. So they think that, well, I guess paranoia sets in. They believe that they're going to be invaded any day. They look at NATO's expansion in Eastern Europe and think that they're under exceptional threat, so they decide that the best defense is a strong offense, and they go on the offensive. And that's, I think, the best rationale I can come up with for why they invaded Ukraine. Of course, they also need a bigger workforce. So, taking over much of Eastern Europe and getting them to work in service to the Russian economy, it's absolutely nothing to do with whether the people in Eastern Europe want that to happen or not, but it would also help to solve, or at least delay, the worst effects of their demographic challenge. But this also points to the fact that there are really only two alternatives. It's that Russia is going to win in Ukraine. Or at least they're going to be held where they are, and it's going to be a long drawn out affair where basically a new border is created, and then armies stand on either side of it, armed to the teeth. Because the only other alternative for the Russians is that the country breaks up, that you get a new administration, and that you're going to get protest movements springing up everywhere. And if Russia were to break up, then the chances of China moving in and taking over Siberia would then be exceptionally high. So we're in an exceptionally difficult geopolitical environment, and there aren't really easy, comfortable answers. But then the question, of course, is about inflation. And the rate of inflation is going to moderate in the second half of this year. So that's just on a pure year-over-year basis. And the Federal Reserve is raising rates faster than anyone else. So that's, on the one hand, that's going to contribute to a recession. And we can think about the fact that the yield curve spread is down now to negative 20 basis points. So we're at a new low in here. What I find especially interesting is that stock markets are rebounding, even though we have an inverted yield curve. It feels like people never learn. This is exactly what we see in every cycle, that people look at an inverted yield curve and they say, oh, well, it's not going to be that bad, or there isn't going to be a recession. Or I saw one quote from somebody at PIMCO today, and it was something to the effect that this is going to be nothing more than a pinch. And I saw an interview with the CEO of Standard Chartered yesterday. So I found it. The quote from PIMCO is that the recession's going to be like a light rain, not a hurricane. And the CEO of Standard Chartered, well, he was speaking with Bloomberg yesterday, and he was saying, yes, there could be a recession, but it's probably going to be very mild. I find that perhaps the most troubling, that we had an exceptionally lengthy bull market. We've had a huge amount of leverage built up. We've had this huge amount of money moving into the technology sector. We've had the assumption that cloud computing was going to take over the world, and it has, and that cloud computing companies could only go up. They don't. Now we have an inverted yield curve, and we have an argument that there's no need to look at the 10-year minus the 2-year because it's not really relevant. We should instead look at the 10-year minus the 3 months. Now, the 10-year minus the 3 months has fallen by 60 basis points this week. This is a phenomenally swift pace of tightening. Just think about the contraction that we saw from the peak in 2013 to the lows in 2019. And to go from 1% to zero in 2019, that took approximately 2 quarters. We've come in from 250 to 60 basis points in the space of a month. So this is evidence of huge volatility in the bond markets. So just the measure of volatility in bonds has been rising exceptionally quickly and is right in the region of the peak from back in 2020. Now it's also very choppy, so let's just look at that on a just a line chart. When we think about why were bond yields, the short end of the curve, so depressed, it was because of people running out of the long end of the curve. So they can't sit in cash and they can't get out of bonds entirely. They have to buy something, so they go exceptionally short duration. Now, with the acceptance that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise rates, well, then they don't want to sit in the short-dated portion of the market any longer. They're willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the fact that front-loading interest rate hikes will control inflation. So you're better off then owning the long end of the curve. Now, when we look at actually look at the yield curve, we can see that we have a very flat condition. The 30-year is at 3% and 9 basis points. And the 2 year is at 3.12. So the 2 year is currently, and the 3 month is now higher than the 2 year and higher than the 30 year. So we're at, I think, excuse me, we're, that is not true. The 3 month is at 2.33. I haven't been using a VR headset, but I am seeing double. Excuse me. The 3 month is rising rapidly. And before we get a recession, it will be inverted. We're at this exceptionally flat yield curve condition. And this is exactly what we see before recessions. I find it very difficult to say whether a recession is going to be mild or deep, because I think it's impossible to know where leverage resides until you start to see real pressure being exerted. But one thing we do know is that when a yield curve becomes inverted, it takes time for the negative consequences to be felt in the wider economy. That's why it's such a good lead indicator for future recessions, because the inverted yield curve condition is a necessary condition for tightening liquidity. And when we get an inverted yield curve and you don't see an immediate reaction, well, then investors tend to think, well, it's not that bad. Or maybe it's not going to be as relevant on this occasion. So we're starting to get rebounds. And I've been anticipating a rebound on the stock market and on the Nasdaq in particular. And that's why I sold out of the most expensive portion of my short position. I will be looking to short it again once we get some, a bit more of a rally, because I think that an inverted yield curve is a very relevant consideration. I've seen a large number of reports crossing my desk. The vast majority of them I'm not allowed to post. But what I've seen repeatedly is the USA may or may not have a recession. Europe will have a recession because of everything that's going on with Russia. That can't be avoided. But the USA probably won't have a recession. And then, of course, we have what's going on in China. So China's GDP growth came out today, and it was a 0.4%, so not negative. And China has only reported a negative quarter once, and that was in 2020 in response to the pandemic. And China's talking about issuing $1 trillion in debt to support the economy and to promote infrastructure development. But if that were really the case, we would see a big rally in copper. And copper prices were steadier in here today, but not in a dynamic fashion. And it's really oversold in the short term. So I lowered my stop again on my short position. But I do think that this is going to be a really interesting chart to monitor. We've seen a really impressive advance in during the pandemic, and now prices have come down in a violent manner. And the bigger question is, if China really is going to re-embark upon outsized monetary and fiscal stimulus, well, that's going to be great news for commodities, but there's no evidence of it just yet. And I think it's also interesting the kinds of riders that they've put on the stimulus. So they're basically saying no off-book borrowing. And will companies have to then face up to their off-book borrowing before they get access to this additional liquidity? These are really significant questions. So, obviously, we're at this very critical juncture for Chinese markets. And there's an evolving protest or evolving protest movement. When you have large numbers of people that refuse to pay their mortgages because the homes that they were promised haven't been built, and the protest movement then registers tens of thousands of people, and then the entire movement is censored. So that's a clear sign that it really is a serious event when the authorities move in and censor it. But the reality is that there's a practice by home developers that they take deposits, and those deposits are put in escrow, and the funds are used to build the property. The property is provided, and all the way along, people are paying their mortgages. And at the moment, those apartments are not being built, and these property developers are running into some serious trouble, significant issues, and people are starting to get really worried about it. And this is a clear protest movement. It's certainly the kind of thing that will be a danger to the Communist Party because 70% of China's savings are in property. And people will protest about that kind of thing, about losing your life savings. It's the kind of thing that certainly will get people out on the street because people need their savings. It's not like that there is a an or what it used to be called the iron rice bowl support system. That just does not exist any longer. People need their savings to provide for their health care and provide for emergency relief whenever the government decides that they're going to lock you in your apartment for 2 months at a time. So, one thing we can think about is copper is used internationally and it's not dominated by any particular cartel. So, what happens is very much a reflection of the market. The other big factor is that with prices coming down, then the input materials for electric vehicles and batteries should be getting cheaper. So, nickel prices have come all the way back down to unwind the spike put in at the beginning of this year. And there's the potential that they'll come down even further. Lithium is a market that is exceptionally I'm just trying to find the carbonate price, excuse me. It's exceptionally dominated by the Chinese market because China has so many of those factories. And that price has not yet started to come down, but it's a Chinese price. So we don't really know how liquid it is. And a lot of lithium is transacted on long-term contracts. Rio Tinto's CEO was also talking in here this week, and the share has been holding up quite a bit better than some of the industrial resources, but it's in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, Rio Tinto is increasing supply of iron ore into an environment where a lot of iron ore facilities have, or excuse me, steel facilities in China have been shut down because of the one, excuse me, the COVID policies that they've implemented. And they're worried about, or Rio Tinto is worried about, the health of the global economy, the war in Ukraine, the shutdowns in China. China is talking about spending $1 trillion, but there's no evidence yet that they've started to do it. They're wedded to trying to achieve their growth targets. And if they're going to achieve those growth targets, well, then they're going to either fake them or they're going to have to spend a ton of money to get it done. We need to answer an answer to the question, where is the liquidity going to come from to fuel a new bull market? Well, $1 trillion from China would be a good start. And that's, of course, assuming that they do it. If we start to see unemployment become problematic in the USA, then that will accelerate the peak in the interest rate hiking cycle. And the jobless rate is trending higher. So we're not yet at a point where it's going to be a really big headwind for the Federal Reserve, but there is no doubt that the number of new jobless claims is trending higher. That also points towards a recession. I am deeply suspicious of this JOLTS report. I don't believe that we have at 12, or well, it's not 12, it's 11.25 million jobs available. Because I look at just the companies I know, and of all the companies that I'm familiar with, I see a large number of them firing people. Now, lots were hiring hand over fist and trying to acquire as many people as possible, and they were on a clear growth trajectory all the way through until about January of this year. But in the last few months, they've seen a substantial slowdown, and they're starting to fire people. So I don't believe that there are 11.25 million jobs available. But it's also worth reminding ourselves that even in 2008, there were 2 million jobs available. And having somewhere in the region of 4.5 million jobs available isn't really all that unusual. But this figure of 11.2 million, well, what we've seen is a lot of people are resigning and people are retiring. The US economy has lost out on about 2 million immigrants because of tighter immigration policies, and probably lost about 1 million workers through retirements. So that's 3 million jobs that would need to be filled. Now, that might be why we have so many higher or so much higher job openings. But the way to fill job openings is either to find the people or that we're going to have an economic contraction and you just won't need as many people. A lot of the airlines are looking for new people. They also have the additional challenge that a lot of their older staff are on very tightly negotiated pension programs. So the airlines have got this challenge that they've got older workforces and then fewer young people willing to work and do the job for what could be substantially less pay. Then you have an acute shortage of baggage handlers in most of the airports. And airports are not back at the capacity that they had before the pandemic, and they are already telling airlines to stop selling seats. That's particularly true in Heathrow. So the volatility that we've had in the airline sector has been quite profound. But when we think, for example, about Lufthansa, that's a company that went bust and had to be bailed out. And it was up in a dynamic manner in here today, and bouncing from the lower side of the evolving base formation. So this is a 3-year base formation. And then we have international consolidated airlines. And it's also bouncing from the lower side of its base formation. So one thing we know for certain is that all of this talk about less travel is really bunkum. That we are social beings and we are people that thrive on social activity. I've been asked to participate in a large number of virtual conferences, and I don't generally. And I keep trying to put up American Airlines, and I keep typing in Anglo American, and Anglo American has pulled back in a really dynamic manner. And it was looking for so long that it was going to hold the first step above the base and failed. Now, if we look at American Airlines, it's also bouncing from the lower side of a more than 2 year base formation. And I saw a really attractive offer from Norwegian Cruise Lines over the week. They were offering, I think it was for a cruise of Antarctica for 2 weeks, setting off from Buenos Aires in January of 2024, and they were offering it for 70% off the second passenger and $100 each for passenger 3 and 4, and for they were throwing in the flights, and you were getting the full package of better food and free excursions on the cruise, and it was going to cost $9,000 with flights included for. I can't remember if that was for two people or for the four people. I can't imagine that the flights would be included for the other two. That's exceptionally cheap if you're talking about flying from any airport to Buenos Aires and back, and then getting your 2 weeks on board your ship with a ocean view room and all of the amenities on board. So definitely the cruises are going to start becoming more popular because I know I was tempted. And if my kids weren't still in school and I just can't take them out of school for 2 weeks in January, I would have bought that offer. And it's these cruise stocks have almost identical chart patterns to the airlines. And the travel sector is going to get better. Now, they're obviously very much impacted by the high cost of energy. So that's obviously problematic. And then they're also heavily impacted by consumer demand growth. So if we have a recession, then these stocks are going to have a lengthy, I guess an even lengthier base formation. But ultimately, inflationary pressures will abate. And the war in Ukraine will probably also then accelerate technological innovation. I find it very interesting that the heat wave in Texas is starting to make international headlines because the regulator sent us all emails during the week to ask us to use less electricity between 2 and 8 p.m. just a couple of days. Well, the first thing is that heat waves in Texas are not unusual. But 1 million people have moved to the Dallas area in the last 5 years. And to Texas in general, it's in excess of 3 million. So the population has increased, and the infrastructure required to produce electricity for all those new homes, all those new people, has not kept up. So this is a growth inelasticity problem rather than an existential problem in terms of the infrastructure. So we're going to have these kinds of teething pains along the way. There are going to be times when we have inflationary pressures rising because we're seeing mass migrations. We're seeing difficulties in getting equipment and people to the places where they're required in time. But the impact is the to and fro, the back and forthing between supply and demand, supply and elasticity and excess demand are going to become less variable as time goes on, and eventually they'll even out. Just like a pendulum, it swings very wide at the beginning, and the longer it swings for, the closer it comes to the equilibrium point. And I suspect that that's what we're going to have with regard to the pandemic and the subsequent money supply, the inflation scare, the tightening of liquidity, the depth of the subsequent recession as the leverage gets squeezed out. The big response subsequently will not be as big as the one before, but it'll be a substantially big response, which will create a new jump in asset prices. But then the central bank will have learned its lesson. They'll start withdrawing it faster the next time. They'll learn too that front loading probably works, so they'll be aggressive in withdrawing liquidity. So we're going to start to have shorter cycles. And the fact that the yield curve spread did not get up to the 300 basis point level and has come down swiftly, I think that supports that argument. So we're in a much more similar environment to the 1980s than we are to the period from 1990 all the way through until 2019. So this 30-year cycle is over, and we're more likely now in a much more volatile phase. So we're going to have big swings, and we're going to have companies that prosper because they have responsible management that don't invest with no aim in mind and don't pull the trigger on or don't have hair sensitivity on their triggers, that they're going to be looking for opportunity and they're going to spec out those opportunities a lot better. And that's the value mindset. So I think it's much more likely that we're moving into a value mindset now than, and probably more than we've had for a very long time. And I guess I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.